طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning, our Palestinian voice is that of Linda Sarsour, an unabashed Palestinian Muslim organizer and activist who was born and still lives in Brooklyn, New York. She discusses her book, We Are Not Here to Be Bystanders, A Memoir of Love and Resistance, with Michael Spath, director of the Indiana Center for Middle East Peace.
We're delighted today to speak with Brooklyn-born Palestinian Muslim activist, author, and proud mother of three, Linda Sarsour. She chronicles her life and activism in her compelling book published earlier this year, We Are Not Here to Be Bystanders, A Memoir of Love and Resistance. Linda, welcome.
Thank you so much, Michael, for having me. Thank you, everyone, for being here.
I'm sure you see a number of names of friends on this screen. I recognize a lot of them as activists from all over the country. So, Linda, again, welcome. I want to get to your book. In fact, I've got a number of questions that arise from things you said in your book, but I say this with lots of love and affection. You're a troublemaker. Already this week, Tuesday, a number of us have been tuning in to the Democratic National Convention. And on Tuesday, your Women's March partner and partner in crime, Tamika Mallory, she spoke at the Democratic Black Caucus, and you appeared on a panel hosted by the DNC's Muslim Delegates and Allies Assembly. I've got some of your quotes here, but why don't I just turn it over to you? Your presence caused a stir among right-wing media, the Republican National Committee, and others, which in turn provoked a response from the Biden campaign. You want to say a word about what all happened and what you had to say and where you stand with the Democrats right now?
Well, thank you for starting there, Michael. Just cut to the chase. It boils down to exactly what you said. I mean, my existence is my resistance, literally. Like my existence, it triggers the right wing of the United States. And I mean right wing as in right wing white nationalists, as in right wing Zionists. I mean, this is just who I am. I'm a good troublemaker. This is what I do for a living. I dedicated the last 21 years of my life to making good trouble around issues that I deeply care about. And so just so you get a little bit of the story quickly so people understand context of what Michael's talking about, I'm an official delegate to the DNC. I am an official delegate from the great state of New York on behalf of my favorite politician in the history of the United States, which is Senator Bernard Sanders. And I was invited by the Muslim Delegates Committee. So let's be clear here. Let's remember what I just said. I am an official delegate to the party. And the Muslim delegates are inviting a Muslim delegate who is one, if not the most prominent Muslim American activist and organizer in the country to speak about Muslim engagement around electoral politics. And in fact, in that Muslim assembly that we had, I never mentioned Israel. I never even mentioned BDS. So that's the really interesting part about what happened this week, that this was an unprovoked attack on myself, but really more so on the communities that I come from, Michael. I am not a fringe leader in the Muslim American community or in the Arab American and Palestinian American communities. I am quite mainstream, meaning that I hold the views of the overwhelming majority of our community. So what happened was a white man spokesperson for the Biden campaign who does not reflect the type of electorate that we are trying to engage in the party, was cornered by right-wing media and also by Jake Tapper from CNN, who many of you know is not a friend to the Palestinian people, nor to the cause of the Palestinian people. And the spokesperson was cornered to say, we condemn her views, without knowing even what I said, that they condemn my views and that they oppose BDS and that they are staunch supporters of the state of Israel and all that. You already know what happened. They go on the rant about how staunchly pro-Israel Joe Biden is. But just so you're clear, Michael, I've been through this many times before, so it doesn't really bother me much. But this time around, it really, really riled up my community in a way that is potentially harmful to the Democratic Party. My community took this personal because when you say that you condemn my views, that means what you're saying is the views that I hold as a Palestinian American in support of Palestinian human rights, in support of the rights of, you know, refugees to return to their original homeland, that you, I support the idea of coexistence, that we as Jews and Palestinians and others can live in a state together in a true democracy. Those are the views that 98.7% of Muslim Americans and Arab Americans and Palestinian Americans hold. And so now my community is demanding a retraction and an apology from the Biden campaign to reiterate that our views, while some may not agree with them, which is fine, are still welcomed in this big tent Democratic Party. So that's what happened. I was minding my own business, Michael, when this all happened.
Your existence is your resistance, is how you put it. And I think that speaks volumes. Well, let's get to your book. I did want you to, I have an opportunity though to address that because it's been all over the news. So thank you. The title of your book, We're Not Here to Be Bystanders, as I read your book, came from the graduation commencement address you gave at Harlem's Apollo Theater to the City University of New York School of Public Health. And you devote an entire chapter of your book to that event and the emotion which filled you heading into that event and subsequent to it. Say a word about the title of your book and that event.
My title of my book really embodies who I am, who I try to be every single day, Michael. And I truly believe in my heart that we are not here on this earth to be bystanders to any form of injustice against any community. And that particular title came from a commencement speech that I did at CUNY Graduate Center that I want to put in context to people so people understand what it means to be a Palestinian Muslim American woman organizing on a high level in this country. What happened was when I was announced as the CUNY City University of New York commencement speaker, right-wing Zionists came out of every woodwork that you could imagine possible. The right wing came out, white nationalists, every right-wing media outlets came out to attack CUNY, which, as you know, is one of the largest college systems that we have in the country, but of course in New York City. And it also represents predominantly low-income people of color who attend our CUNY system. And so having me as a product of CUNY, having me as a woman of color born and raised in New York City, was the perfect person to have as the CUNY commencement speaker. Majority of the graduates were people of color and were from low-income communities. And they, in fact, the students chose me as their commencement speaker. And so I was attacked on the highest level possible, to the point where every single celebrity alt-right leader in America flew to New York City and actually organized a rally outside of the CUNY administrative offices. Anyone from Milo Yiannopoulos, Richard Spencer, Gavin McGinnis, Dove Hyken, Pamela Geller, you name the Islamophobe, and they were there.
Yeah.
And they called the event Cancel Sarsour. What was beautiful was the response that they got, which was from the CUNY chancellor and also from professors and students across the CUNY system who said, absolutely not. Linda Sarsour will speak at this graduation. We will not cancel her. She has the right to say whatever it is she wants to say. New Yorkers, Jewish Americans stood up for me across the country. But amidst all of that, Michael, I received death threats. I received mail to my home. My children were targeted. This is the life that I have to live every day just for being a vocal Palestinian American. And so what happened was the CUNY speech happened at the Apollo Theater. There were more cops at the Apollo Theater than there were graduates. And I was very apologetic to the graduates there that this is the graduation they had to have, that they had to be, you know, so much security and cops. And you know what the graduates said to me? they said, no, this is going to be the most memorable graduation that anyone ever had. And it's going to be a graduation that goes down in history. And so when I went up to the stage, Michael, as other commencement speakers in the past, like Betsy DeVos, you know, people walk out, people turn their backs. I received a standing ovation from that entire auditorium. And I was welcomed there with so much love for who I am and for what I represent. And the reason why I said we are not here to be bystanders is I shared a story, if many of you remember. There was a story in 2017 where these three young men were in a train station in Portland, Oregon, and a Muslim American girl and her Black friend were in the train being harassed and assaulted by a white man in his late 40s. And these men decided that they were not going to be bystanders to this type of hate. And what they did was is they actually put their physical bodies in harm's way to the point where two of those men lost their lives. They were stabbed to death. One of them was a father who had four children. Another one was someone who was very beloved in the communities that he came from. And only one man lived to tell the story, which is a young poet who lived to tell the story and did not regret one second that he too was harmed, although he was able to continue and, of course, was not killed. So my tribute in the day of that CUNY commencement speech was to say to people, those men decided not to be bystanders. We have to decide not to be bystanders, and that we have to every single day decide that when we see injustice happening against any individual or any community, that we have to stand up for them. And Michael, that is my faith that I follow. And it is the type of spirit that I have been that my parents instilled in me as a Palestinian American.
You dedicated that talk to their memory.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You begin your book, which, as I mentioned beforehand, it was compelling, and I just really appreciated the transparency and honesty of your narrative. You begin your book by describing at 19 years old, choosing a particular piece of clothing from a family friend's suitcase she brought back from the Hajj in Mecca. You put it on, and this is how you describe it. For the first time in my 19 years, I appeared to the world as exactly what I was, unapologetically Muslim. I remember placing a palm over the mound of my belly and thinking simply, this is it. And also you say, all my life, I had yearned for a visible identity in the world. And that morning, seeing my reflection in the hallway mirror, I had found it at last. That was the day I began to feel whole.
For me, you know, growing up, and I wrote about this in my book, you know, my name is Linda. I was born with that name. My parents, you know, had come to America as new immigrants, you know, came from living under a military occupation. And they wanted to ensure, Michael, that I had the best life that I could have. And I think when you're a new immigrant, my parents made the decision to give me a name that wasn't like Fatima or Khadija or something that would be seen as foreign to the United States, or at least in the perspective of my parents, foreign. So giving me a name like Linda, which was, they named me after like a song. And so anyway, I grew up, you know, as you can see, fair skin, I have Black hair, and my name was Linda. And I was a very ambiguous kid. Nobody really knew where I was from, and that there was something always empty inside of me. And as I also wrote about in my book, even trying to explain to, you know, kids in your class in middle school that you're Palestinian, and trying to go show kids where Palestine was on a map, and not being able to even do that, there was just a void in my heart, and it was there for a really long time. And so for me, I was missing something in my identity, and I wanted to show up somewhere, and I wanted people to know what I was and who I was. And so for me, my hijab became a symbol of an identity that I could walk into any room, Michael, and the first thing you will know about me is you will know I'm a Muslim. You may not know anything else about me, but you will know I'm a Muslim. And that was very important to me. And as I grew older, I wore my hijab when I was 19 years old. And as I continued to organize, I started studying Islam in a way that I hadn't when I was younger. And I became very close to my faith, believing that Islam, you know, oftentimes people will say Islam is a religion of peace. And I truly believe that. I believe all Abrahamic faiths and even other faiths like Sikhism and Buddhism and others are religions of peace. But what's more important to me, Michael, about my faith is that it is a religion of justice. And what I say to people all the time is you cannot have peace without justice. And so I have taken the charge from my faith to stand up for the most marginalized people and to follow in the footsteps of my beloved prophet Muhammad, may peace and blessings be upon him, who in every story told about him You would never find him with Pharaoh. You would never find him amongst the powerful people or amongst those he felt to be the most influential. He was always amongst the widows and the orphans and the poor and the sick and the people that he knew needed him the most and those that required his mercy. And so what I'm trying to do, Michael, and in my life is I am trying to be a mercy to the people and show kindness and compassion to people. And I also am a fighter. I believe in truth telling, and I don't believe that we can only tell truth when it's comfortable. We have to be able to tell truth all the time. And oftentimes the truth is uncomfortable. And so I have become an uncomfortable leader, someone who creates a lot of controversy, not because the things that I say are wrong. It is because the things that I say are new to people and people have not been able to hear them on the largest and highest platforms. And so I'm going to continue to be a truth teller, a justice seeker, and someone who will always fight and defend the most marginalized people in my country.
The true meaning of jihad.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I started there, Michael. I don't know, for folks who haven't read my book, my editors at Simon & Schuster, when I started writing my book, I started the introduction with, "What is my jihad?" And one of my editors was like, "Really? Is that really where you want to start?" And I said to them, "Listen, it's my book, and I feel like it is my responsibility to take these terms that have been co-opted by the right wing and Islamophobes to, in fact, put them in a context and to get people to understand these terminology from the perspective of the people who actually, you know, jihad is not an English word. It's an Arabic word. Fluent Arabic speakers should be able to translate these words. Islam, our faith, people who are Muslim should be able to translate these words." So I started my book in that place. And so many people, Michael, who've read my books, people that I've never, ever, it spoke to them. I don't even know who they are. You know, women that were like emailing me from like rural Arkansas being like, "I read your book," and like they couldn't believe how many things in my book, you know, were things that went against everything that they had known before. And so I'm very grateful that I was given an opportunity to write a book from the perspective of the many people that I represent in the communities that I come from. And jihad is an internal struggle. You know, it is my jihad every day, Michael, to be a better person than I was the day before. It is my jihad to, you know, get college degrees. It is my jihad to, you know, raise my children to be the best that they can be. Every single day, all of us, Michael, go through these internal struggles with ourselves. And that is the most important concept of jihad. Does jihad also mean war? And does it mean to defend your faith and defend your land? Of course it does. But that's the last form and the last resort when it comes to this idea of being able to struggle in this world.
Absolutely. I want to take you back to the Women's March, to January 21st, 2017. That's, you've been active on the public scene for many, many years, but that has been a way that has been one of the forums by which you became really into the public eye nationally and globally. You speak with such joy and pride of that day. This is how you put it in your book. "I was my Palestinian grandmother's wildest dream. I stand here before you unapologetically Muslim American, unapologetically Palestinian American, unapologetically from Brooklyn, New York. Sisters and brothers, you are my hope for my community." Tell us a little bit more about that day and the rest of your message.
You know, Michael, my grandmother was born in 1927, which means she was 21 years old when the creation of the State of Israel happened. So my grandmother was an adult. You know, I come from a displaced family, you know, a family that has experienced a lot at the hands of the Israeli government. And my grandmother, you know, in 2017, when the Women's March happened, to have a Palestinian American woman like me with the type of voice that I have and also in a hijab, as you can see, was something that it was much bigger than I was. And it was really for the Palestinian people who watched me in Palestine on live stream, including my own grandmother. Was my grandmother said, "I'm going to die a very happy and proud Palestinian grandmother."
Wow.
And my grandmother did die, Michael, in 2018 after the second Women's March. And there, for people like me who have been so long marginalized in this country, our views marginalized, and watching the very country that I live and love, which is the United States of America, continue to fund the occupation of my grandparents and my aunts and uncles and my cousins and those that I love in Palestine. But for my grandmother and my family in Palestine to see the emergence of my voice in this country as a voice of justice for the Palestinian people, not at the expense of anyone else, Michael. When I say justice for Palestinians, it is not at the expense of the Jews who live with us in that land. Justice for me is justice for all. And my grandparents have died happy people, knowing that the next generation and the next generation of Palestinians will continue to raise our voices and to continue to fight for a free Palestine. And I am grateful that I have been given the opportunities that I have been given to continue to be that voice.
You know, I'm gonna come back to the Women's March, but as long as you talked about your grandmother and your grandparents, the memories you share about the summers spent with your family, especially your grandmother's in the little Palestinian village of Al Bira, just a few miles north of Jerusalem. How have those memories shaped you? And if you don't mind, share too about the significance of the olive beads you wear on your right wrist, a gift from your beloved Basima. Linda, what I'm asking you to share with us is, how do you carry Palestine in your heart? Talk to us about that.
So, they're actually not in the same room that I'm in right now, but I have these bracelets that are little balls made out of the scraps of olive trees that were gifted to me by my mentor, who passed away in a very tragic car accident back in 2005. And they represent something that is very significant to Palestinian culture and the Palestinian history, which are olive trees. Olive trees, as you know, are very important to the Palestinian people. They are trees that can live for thousands and thousands of years. And they are also one of the most deeply rooted trees. The roots of olive trees are very deep and go deeper than many other trees. And so the Basima gave me those to remind me always. And she had a foresight for me that one day you are going to be a very powerful leader and voice, and you will be attacked, and you will be disparaged, and you will be discouraged, and you will be marginalized. And remember that you are a Palestinian, and that you, these olive trees represent who you are, a deeply rooted person with a history that goes back thousands of years. And so those bracelets mean a lot to me. That's one thing that I carry with me every day. And another thing, Michael, is you probably have heard me speak at many events across the country. One of the things, and I said this at the Women's March the day on 2017, I said, I stand here before you unapologetically Palestinian American. And so my Palestinian identity goes with me everywhere, Michael, because it's who I am. And I'm not going to hide that part of my identity because it makes some people feel uncomfortable. I am entitled to be a full human being and to bring all my identities to the table. And when I do that, it allows others, Michael, to do the same, not just Palestinians, but it allows someone to be unapologetically Black and unapologetically Latina and maybe unapologetically Latina LGBTQIA and maybe someone who's a proud progressive Jew. You know, whatever it is that you are, you get to be all of you. And I'm trying to model what it means to be unapologetic.
And the time that you spent with your grandmothers in Al Bira, and do you want to say a little bit more about that? Those summers that you spent there, you refer to that quite movingly in your book.
You know, I have had the privilege of being part of a Palestinian family. Both my parents are immigrants to the United States who felt the need and the importance of us traveling to Palestine almost every summer. So I am a fluent Arab, I'm a fluent Arabic speaker. Not only do I speak the fluent Arabic language, I also speak fluent dialect from my Palestinian village that I come from, which is El Bire outside of Ramallah. And I think that my village where I was able to really experience things that a lot of young people don't experience at my age. And I mean, I wrote about, you know, going to visit my uncle when I was 7 years old in 1987. My uncle was in a Israeli prison. He was picked up with a group of men that was never charged of any crime, never had a trial, never saw a judge, just detained. for an indefinite period of time and, of course, eventually released. And so to meet my uncle behind bars and trying to understand what it means to be Palestinian, to live under a military occupation, I also went to Jerusalem and to kind of be connected to my faith tradition and to see how in Jerusalem, the coexistence of different faith traditions, you know, whether it be going to the Church of Nativity, seeing the wall, and of course, going to the both mosques there. And so Palestine is not just something theoretical to me, Michael, something that as a Palestinian American, I know about from afar. I've experienced it. I lived it. I've seen the Israeli military in our villages. I've experienced, at night, I remember being in Palestine in 2014. And I remember, the curfews, the not being able to go outside and trying to explain to my own children at the time who were very young, like, what do you mean we can't go outside? And having to explain to them what it means to live under a military occupation. And so it has shaped my views on the world. And my village is a beautiful village that has, it is right, 5 minutes outside of Ramallah. It is part of the occupied West Bank. And in order for people in my family to travel there, especially if they are born Palestinians, my son, derivative of his father, who was born in Palestine, my son, who's an American, has Palestinian documentation, which means that my American child born in Brooklyn is not allowed to go to Tel Aviv airport to go to Palestine to visit his grandparents. He has to go to Jordan and cross the bridge in. And so these types of injustices are things that I've been talking about in my experience traveling to Palestine. And really a lot of people in this country, Michael, don't even know these experiences. And when they hear them, they're like, what do you mean? You're an American. You should get to go to any airport that you want. But Palestinian Americans are banned from going to travel to their own homeland through the Tel Aviv airport, built on a village that was destroyed by the Israeli government. I mean, the irony of it is,
Let me take you back to the Women's March. You write very frankly that in organizing the Women's March and in its aftermath, there were things that Carmen, Tamika, Bob Bland, and you, I don't know how else to say it, but things that you had to teach your white feminist partners. And that work still continues. What are some of the lessons that you're finding you still need to teach white men and women, and also just men and women of privilege?
I think we've come a long way, but that test is going to be in 2020 to see if we really got to a better place, Michael, on these issues. Right now, as we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of women's right to vote. And what a lot of people always forget is that it's only the 100th anniversary of the white women's right to vote. And in fact, women of color and Black women didn't get the right to vote till decades later. And so I think what we've been really talking to white women about in particular over the years is really trying to give them an opportunity to look at issues through a racial justice lens. So issues around equal pay, for example. Of course, I want women to get paid the same as men for the same work and same qualifications. But we also have to ponder on the fact that Black women still don't get paid the same as white women, and women, immigrant women don't get paid the same as Black and white women. So what we really did across the time that we were at the Women's March is trying to explain to white women that criminal justice reform is a feminist issue. Climate justice is a feminist issue. Global justice and an end to wars is a woman's issue. And oftentimes in the larger kind of more white-led feminist movement, they've been very specific about reproductive rights, equal pay, and issues that are not very intersectional. And I think my role has been as an intersectional leader is to bring white women along to basically say to them, listen, your liberation in the United States of America for you to have full control over your life, over your body, is intertwined with those of Black women and women, other women of color and other marginalized women. And I think we've made some progress, but unfortunately, there are some white women who are maybe a little threatened by the leadership of women of color because we are, quite radical in our politics and the way that we organize. And you know why, Michael? Because we have to be. We don't have time to wait. We can't, this incrementalism just doesn't work for us anymore. We've had too many people in our community deported, too many Black people being killed on the streets of our communities, too many wars that have killed millions of people across the world, including almost a million Iraqis in an unjust war that we shouldn't have had in the first place. And we are, women of color are committed to diplomacy over war. I mean, the military industrial complex in this country has taken resources away from hospitals, from social service programs that we need in this country. When I go to Chicago and you tell me I had to shut down 10 schools in Chicago, but we still figure out how to find $10 million a day to give to Israel. Like, somebody has to be able to explain this to the American people. It doesn't work. And the fact that the large majority of our military aid goes to Egypt and goes to Israel, but then we can't have healthcare for all people during a global pandemic. Like, we still live in a country where people don't support this idea of Medicare for all. Like, how is it possible that almost 200,000 Americans have died, Michael? Some of them people we love, from a global pandemic. Some people dying without healthcare. It's not okay. And so that's kind of the courageous conversation we've had to have with white women. We've also had to have the conversation around Israel-Palestine. You know, as a women's march, as you know, we were a protest movement, Michael. That was the point of the women's march. And so in the platform of the women's march, we did say that we will not stand by at the criminalization of any protesters and Americans who want to engage in the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. Not because not just BDS on Israel, but BDS on Saudi Arabia, BDS on China when it comes to their treatment of Uyghur Muslims. You know, boycott is part of a long tradition of nonviolent resistance to human rights violations. And so if you're going to be against BDS when it comes to Palestine, then were you against the BDS when it came to the Montgomery bus boycott or South African apartheid? And so I don't expect everyone to agree with us, Michael. But what I do expect white folks in particular, white Jews and white, you know, Christians and others, is to understand that our liberation is bound up together. There's no way around it. You know, and our Jewish sisters and brothers, you know, particularly those who are white Jews, and I've had this courageous conversation, Michael, many times, you know, they have conditional whiteness, you know, that you can be white, but it's very conditional. This is a nation that has many times often has sent and signaled to Jewish communities. We have an anti-Semite in the White House right now. We know in the 1930s, we sent Jewish refugees back to Europe. You know, we have seen an uptick in anti-Semitic attacks against Jewish communities and synagogues. And so when I say to people, and I say to my sisters and brothers in the Jewish community, our liberation is bound up with one another. And guess what? When the bad stuff really happens, Michael, guess who's going to be out there fighting with my life for the people of this country? It is going to be me, because that's what I've been doing for the last 20 years of my life. And I'm going to continue to do that to the last days of my life.
Let me, by the way, there's so many comments in the chat room of love and affection and support coming from your friends all around the country. So I wanted you to be aware of that. Let me follow up what you just said. You write, and I found this to be, I've quoted this already a number of times with small groups that I've been involved with. You write that you've, I'm quoting now, developed one tried and true principle: follow Black women, trust Black women. Black women will never lead you astray. So say more about that, and especially the overlap between the goals of the Black Lives Movement and those of Muslims and Palestinians and really of all marginalized peoples.
You know, when I think about all the movements that I'm a part of, Michael, majority of the movements that I'm a part of are led by Black women, and they have put in a lot of labor, and they're willing to sacrifice a lot for our movement. We also watched them in the 2016 election. 94% of Black women went to the polls and voted for Hillary Clinton. Not because 94% of Black women thought Hillary Clinton was the best candidate or that she was the most amazing thing that ever happened to us. They voted for Hillary Clinton because they knew it was the right thing to do to alleviate the harm that this administration was going to commit against marginalized people. They also believed that the Clinton administration was going to be an administration that might have absolutely been status quo, but that would not have elevated the harms that were already happening to Black people and immigrant communities, et cetera. And so oftentimes we have watched Black women step up and do the right thing and over on the behalfs of all of us. And it's time for us just to follow their leadership. And what's the worst that's going to happen, Michael? I mean, when I was watching the DNC convention and I listened to Michelle Obama, I thought, you know, I was, she moved me to a deep place. I mean, this is a woman who's brilliant and understands, you know, the struggles that we're going through right now. I watched the brilliance of the Ayanna Presleys and the Ilhan Omars and the, you know, Karen Basses and the Barbara Lees in Congress. I want to remind people that immediately after the horrific attacks of 9/11, Barbara Lee, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, singly one person. She was the only vote against the war on Afghanistan. A black woman stood up in a Congress that has 437 people and by herself stood up against the entire Congress and said, I vote no on the war on Afghanistan. That is who black women are. They are willing to speak the truth. They are willing to do the work. And it is about time that we stop making them take on all the labor that all of us should be in. And that is why I follow their leadership. I pick up whatever they don't want to do. I support their labor. I want to make sure that the burden that they carry is not as heavy as it has been for the last 400 years. And I truly believe that one day we are going to have a black woman president in America. And that is truly when real change is going to come to our communities. That's where I came from, Michael. I came as a local organizer. I'm a person that really holds both. I'm not a pundit. I'm not a national talking head. I'm a grassroots organizer from the streets of Southwest Brooklyn, which is my neighborhood, Bay Ridge. And it is home to one of the largest Arab American and Muslim American communities in the state of New York. We have done such powerful work to build up the power of Arab American and Muslim American voters in the district. I have registered thousands of voters and new Americans in the area. I have ran candidates in the area. I have helped to defeat two Republicans in my district. At one point, every single representative who represented me in my district, whether on the federal or local level, have been Republican. So now we have our member of Congress we flipped the Republican seat in Congress. We have now flipped a Republican seat in our state legislature in my district at the hands of the power that the Arab American and Muslim American communities are building in mind. And so I'm very proud to be from Brooklyn and from Bay Ridge. Bay Ridge is actually an interesting place. It's a place that's experiencing the opposite of gentrification. And what I mean by that is in a lot of parts of New York City, as you know, a lot of the, you know, traditional old black community and, you know, the traditional black community or, you know, old Puerto Rican communities and other kind of communities that we have in New York, are now being gentrified by, you know, white folks, particularly young white people. And my neighborhood has the opposite. We are in a traditionally white neighborhood, Norwegian, Greek, Italian community, Irish community, and have an influx of Arab American, Muslim American, Latino, and Asian American folks coming into the community. So it's really beautiful to see how diverse my community has become and my neighborhood has become over the course of the last almost 20 years.
We've had a number of questions in the chat room about Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, the DNC, their stands on Palestine and Israel, and your work as a delegate, and then your activism work building up to the November election. So talk to us a little bit about just your take now as a delegate. And I mean, we all know who are on this call that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are no friends of the Palestinians and haven't been. In fact, they've received so much support from AIPAC and other supporters of Israel. But so on the other hand, we want to work against fascism, do we not? And so you've been a delegate you were a spokesperson for Bernie Sanders. Talk to us a little bit about your activism from now until November and then beyond.
Absolutely. You know, Michael, everybody plays a different role in this movement. And I'm never going to be an ambassador to the Democratic Party until the Democratic Party speaks to the issues that communities I come from care about and also respects the communities that I come from. And so I always say to people, I'm what they call a small letter D. I'm not a capital D. And I understand the Democratic Party as a tool for us to continue to build power and build influence around the issues that we care about. I am a very proud delegate for Bernie Sanders from the great state of New York. I am someone who supported Bernie Sanders back in 2015, 2016, when it was not popular. And I continue to be very close to Bernie over the last few years and really am moved by his commitment and consistency and persistency over the last four decades when it has come to pretty much every issue. I, as a delegate for the convention, just so that I'm quite, you know, transparent, I voted number one for Bernie Sanders as, you know, my nominee. I also voted no against the Democratic platform. And that is what democracy looks like. I did not go to be a delegate so that I could just fall in line, Michael. And that's the problem that we have every 4 years, that we are all expected just to fall in line. It's not going to work anymore. But I also understand that this is not any old election. This is an election about whether we are, as a country, are going to accept 4 more years of fascism. And I'm a bigger person, and I understand how much harm this administration has accelerated on the communities that I come from and organize with. So my role really has been in the larger electoral sphere is to convince progressives, and I don't mean the progressives except for Palestine, I mean progressives, the real progressives, and also Muslim and Arab American and Palestinian communities. I have tried to convince them that when we're voting in a presidential election, Michael, we're not voting for who the best president is going to be, or at least we haven't gotten to the place where we're actually voting for the best person. And I mean right now in this general election. What I have framed for people is that this is an election about who do you want your opponent in the White House to be? And I am choosing my opponent to be Biden, because I don't believe that we can move anything under a Trump administration. You can't move a fascist, Michael. You just can't. It doesn't work. It's never worked. There's no example of any of it anywhere around the world where some progressive movement was able to build enough power to move a fascist. Fascists can do horrible, horrible things to people. And I'm not going to be a part of that. So what I've been saying to progressives who have actually really, reflected on my framing is that Biden is not a friend to the Palestinian people. Biden is a hawk when it comes to wars, and he voted for the war in Iraq. And he doesn't support Medicare for all. And I can go on and on. But what I do believe, Michael, is that we could build a very strong, consistent movement around a Biden-Harris administration to force their hand to do the right thing. Because we did not do that, Michael, under the Obama administration. What happened with Obama, as you know, is we were too busy embracing this historic moment of electing the first Black president, which I was very proud of. And we also knew a lot about Obama. We knew that he was a constitutional lawyer. We knew that he was an organizer from the South Side of Chicago. He was Black, which meant that he was a member of a marginalized community, and we put a lot of hope in him. And we really left him out to dry. We expected him to do the right thing, because what else would he do? And he eventually got surrounded by, some of the old traditional folks in the Democratic Party. We didn't give him a movement of resistance outside, except maybe for a couple of elements like the undocumented kids did, and kind of forced his hand to do some things. But overall, we didn't, Michael. The anti-war movement went to bed. A lot of our movements kind of were dormant a little bit. And then we expected him to do the right thing, and he didn't do the right thing many times. And so what I'm saying to people is I'm not going to be that person. I'm going to be part of a resistance under the Trump administration, if that is to happen. But I will be a thorn in the side of Biden and Harris when they get into that White House.
I remember when we hosted Stephen Zunis, the political scientist here, at the very beginning of the Obama administration, what was it now, 12 years ago or so. And he said he had had a private conversation with Barack Obama, and Obama confided to him over dinner one night that progressives, activists needed to, something like, it's almost an exact quote, build a critical enough mass so that would give him permission to do the right thing he knew he needed to do. Something like that. And I think that's what you're talking about. Just a couple more questions, Linda. So the DNC and Biden and Harris, we need to hold their feet to the fire. Yet there have been some positive signs, right? The Elliot Engel was ousted by Jamal Bowman in New York. Two of your buddies, right, Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, won their primaries, as did Cori Bush, African-American woman in Missouri who beat out William Lacy Clay, a 12-term, right, pro-Israel African-American. And Betty McCollum, too, and some of her colleagues, including Indiana's Andre Carson, have introduced the Israeli Annexation Non-Recognition Act. So there are hopeful signs. There have been signs that BDS is continuing to work. So talk to us a little bit more about these heartening signs and the work that still needs to be done.
You know, even this whole recent couple of days around the DNC and my presence at the DNC as an official delegate at the Muslim Assembly, you know, the backlash is what I call the last gasps of air from the right wing. And if it made them feel any better that the Biden administration was like, Linda's not part of the campaign and we support Israel, if that made them feel better, well, I hope they enjoy that. Because what really is happening in our country is that more people, Michael, are aligning with my politics. You know, more progressives than ever before are more courageously talking about free Palestine. More progressives are supporting the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. And so we are in a moment right now when you can take someone like Cori Bush, who is a brilliant Black woman from St. Louis. She was the Ferguson protester, supporter of Palestinian human rights, supporter of the BDS movement, and is a democratic socialist who beats Clay, who, as you know, is not only is he a 12-term incumbent, he came after his father. We're right. Talking about a 50-year dynasty in Congress. You know, Elliot Engel was, one of the most influential members of Congress. He was around for a really long time. He was the chair of the House Foreign Relations Committee and, you know, had a lot of resources and, you know, a lot of support in Congress. And here comes a brilliant young Black man who's a principal of a middle school in New York who says, I want to be the change that I want to see, who ran as a democratic socialist, who supports the Palestinian people and human rights of the Palestinian people. He supports the idea of conditioning aid to Israel in order to push them to stop violating the human rights of the Palestinian people. Ilhan and Rashida, Michael, were called vulnerable. Ilhan, AOC, and Rashida, according to every media pundit and every political analyst, were vulnerable. Not only were they not vulnerable, they crushed every pro-Israel lobby organization in America single-handedly. And so what gives me that kind of sense of optimism that I have is that instead of me becoming more fringe, I'm the one moving more towards the mainstream and they're the ones moving to the fringe. And I'm okay with that, Michael. And it's going to maybe take a few more years for the voices of peace and justice to be mainstream in the Democratic Party. But what I will tell you is that if you thought from 2018 to 2020 was spicy in Congress, wait until you hear Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush in Congress. Like, it's going to be amazing what we're going to be able to see and the type of courage that we're going to hear in the next 2 years.
You have been listening to Palestinian activist Linda Sarsour discussing her book and her organizing goals with Michael Spath, director of the Indiana Center for Middle East Peace. And that is it for today. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here every week at the same time and same place on your radio dial. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. To listen to our permanent archive, to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم